Welcome to the Accelerating Operational Performance Podcast. I'm Greg Schenkel, President of Unique Training and Development and Frontline Leadership Systems, and our mandate here at the podcast is to bring you practical ideas that will help you accelerate some of the initiatives that you have going on the shop floor and also help you with your career progression to fulfill your full potential. And this podcast is brought to you by our new series of frontline leadership programs. Many people will know us for Frontline Leadership, our three-day leadership development program for supervisors, team leaders, and managers. And now we've expanded that to be three different components. One is Frontline Leadership Strength and Essentials. The second is Frontline Leadership Drive Performance. And the last is Amplify Impact. And so if any of those are of interest to you, of course, you can visit us on our website at uniquedevelopment.com. I'm really excited about our guest on the podcast for this episode. It is a longtime colleague and associate of mine, Videsh Subramanian. And I'd like to talk to you about Videsh before he comes on camera. First of all, he's joining us in the studio, which isn't usual. Many times, of course, we do it remotely, so I'm excited that he's here in the studio with me. Videsh is a lean and continuous improvement expert. He's a professional engineer, and he's not just about the theory. He's got over 26 years of experience making things happen. He does have his master's in mechanical engineering and metallurgy, and he earned his executive MBA from the Ivy Business School at Western University. In fact, Videsh and I are both Ivy alumni. He's also a certified quality engineer. Really, his expertise is in Lean, Six Sigma, continuous improvement, operational excellence. And as you're going to hear in our interview, he is just exceptional at taking a very practical view of what works and what really impacts clients. So I've known Videsh for more than 20 years. I refer him many times to clients who are looking at doing work in Lean and continuous improvement. And I've had a lot of phone calls with Videsh where he really educates me on a totally different perspective on lean and continuous improvement. And I'm just excited to capture some of that, those great conversations here on the podcast. So please join me in welcoming Videsh Subramanian. Hey, Videsh, thank you for being here.
Thank you so much for giving me the chance to be here with you.
Yeah. By the way, Videsh's website is aimsinc.ca if you need to reach out to him, or he's also very active on LinkedIn. So, Videsh, we've had so many good discussions over the years about lean and continuous improvement, and maybe the most surprising thing is that whenever I talk to you about it, you always have this unique or different take. But maybe we should start back at the beginning. Because for me, lean is just something I became aware of, well, in my case, probably in the late 80s. And it seems to have sort of really been talked about then. But you told me that lean actually goes way back even hundreds of years earlier than that. I'm just curious about the origin story.
Yeah, that is exactly right, Greg. So if we look at the thinking behind lean, that thinking has been prevalent from 1800s.
Wow.
When they were using the concept to build ships for the warfare. Yeah. So the thinking goes back a long time, but it became more common lingo maybe in the last 25, 30 years.
And you said that really was a result of some publications from MIT. And from the way I understand it, lean goes back or gets really tied back into Deming's work. And I just wondered, can you comment on that? And why did in your opinion, why did the Japanese really embrace it maybe more than we did in North America to start with? And then we kind of took it from there.
Yeah, it's kind of very funny. After World War II, Dr. Deming was sent to Japan to help Japan rebuild. He used to have those standard four-day classes. And it is said that in one of the classes in Japan, the participants in his class, they had a control of 85% of Japan's GDP.
Oh, wow.
85%. And those leaders truly understood Deming's teaching on profound knowledge. Not only talk about it, but actually live it. really live it. And right, wrong, indifferent, I am a devout follower of Dr. Deming and the follow-up work from Dr. Deming by Dr. Senge at MIT called The Fifth Discipline. So it ties in very nicely where the focus is on letting people be the best they can be.
Yeah.
And therefore, you get the outcome like throughput, quality, etc.
Okay, so you've kind of answered one of the questions that I had, because one of the things that you told me is that although people really focus on lean, but you say most people take lean from a cost reduction viewpoint, and they really should be thinking about it maybe more holistically around bringing the most or the best out of people. What do you mean by bringing the best out of people?
A very good question, Greg, and that is exactly why less than 2% of the organization that starts on the journey, they stay on the journey because they understand the core thinking behind profound knowledge and systems thinking. Both are very important. If I look at lean, OPEX, CI, purely from a cost-cutting point of view, there is no incentive for anyone to improve after the target is reached. And also, if I focus only on cost-cutting, I treat people as an expense. The moment they realize you're treating me as an expense, there is no incentive for the team members to contribute more.
Interesting. So it's actually something that essentially limits the upside and the commitment of people to actually execute it. So I think that's, even though it's a fairly simple concept, I think it's profound. And I think your comment on that only a very small percentage of companies truly get as far as they would have hoped for in their lean journey is probably because of that thing, right? They take, I guess the saying is that they take advantage of the low-hanging fruit and they get some savings initially, but they don't really put it deep into their bones. Is that kind of what you're talking about?
Exactly correct. So if we go into the depth of profound knowledge which Dr. Deming talks about, Dr. Deming would say, when things don't work, I'm not getting the throughput, I'm not getting the on-time delivery, I'm not getting the PPM, etc., 90% of the time when you have that outcome, it is because the system is not capable of giving you that outcome consistently.
Consistently, yeah.
So then I need to ask the question, who owns the system?
Mm-hmm.
And in my work, I always start with leadership, and I want to make sure they realize the tremendous impact the leaders have on the outcome. Normally, we pick the frontline team members, the supervisors, and the managers and crack the whip. Why is it not getting done? But if I'm honest with myself and I step back, why is it not being done? It's very quickly you've realized that the system is not set up to give you the required outcome. And in my view, the ownership for system design is with leaders.
Interesting. So, of course, that captivates our attention because we're in the leadership development business. And interestingly enough, that in addition to the frontline leadership program that most people know us for, we've developed this site leader program or plant manager program, recognizing that the site leader really takes initial responsibility for looking at the robustness of their processes and needs to constantly be aware of where the waste is, but also understand that the waste is partly, again, maybe not due to their leadership, but their leadership affects whether people see the waste and understand it and,
yes,
and understand the primary responsibility of finding a better way forward.
Mm-hmm.
But one thing that I did want to run by you is that we have this model called decision-making waste, right?
Yes.
And what we say is that there's, if you look at the most senior person in the organization, down through the middle management, down to the frontline supervisor, down to the frontline team member or employee, the people closest to the work should really be the people who are primarily responsible for running the business.
Yes.
That the people in the middle are primarily responsible for helping improve the business, and the folks at the top are growing the business. But in a lot of manufacturing or industrial companies, everybody swarms down to run the business.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering whether you have any commentary on that, and how do you sort of get management to do what they're supposed to do while you let the frontline folks really own the work that they're responsible for?
Yeah, a very good point there, Greg. And I want to go back to one of my personal lessons learned working at the Toyota plant in Cambridge, Ontario. We were working on the launch of the Solara convertible car, the first convertible in North America from Toyota. And this platform got moved from Cambridge to Kentucky. And our question to leadership was, why are you doing that? And it's a funny what he told us. He said, we are bringing the Lexus line outside Japan for the very first time into Cambridge. Mm. This is, why are we doing that? And it's a very nice example he gave us. He said, if I look at the structure in Cambridge, top to bottom, the whole structure, and we are looking for problem-solving capability. Mm-hmm. It is most prevalent at all levels in the organization. That basically means, going back to what you said earlier, Greg, that the team members can solve problems that is owned by the team members. Mm-hmm. The team leaders solve what they own. The assistant managers solve what they own. So people are responsible, accountable for what level they are working at. Mm. In my work, I prevent managers from going and solving problems at the frontline level, because that you take the respect away from right. the team members.
Yeah.
We have to be patient. We have to coach them. We have to train them. We need to hold their hands. They will make mistakes. We have to celebrate mistakes.
Mm, interesting. So, you know, one of the aspects of trying to help companies avoid this decision-making waste where everyone's doing the job that somebody else should
yes.
be taking care of, one of the, so of course what we do is we build up the capabilities and the confidence level of the frontline leaders. But one aspect that I think companies are struggling with is this issue of how do I transfer some degree of ownership to the leader who's running a work cell or department to be responsible for how that department is running. I still think that a lot of companies, management is monitoring performance, and then management comes down and tells you whether you're doing a good job or not. And, you know, if it's not going well, either management tells you how to do better, but doesn't facilitate sort of how to do better from the people who own it. Do you have any comment about this idea of active management where the sort of the people closest to the work own what they should own as far as how the machines are running? Do you have any commentary on that?
Oh, absolutely, Greg. And this is where I start with my clients. I use a phrase called the Hoshin process, a mm-hmm. very, very powerful thought process where, starting with the CEO, the president, and the board member, they decide I have to go from where I am to 2x, whatever mm-hmm. the X is. Mm-hmm. Once we define that goal, mm-hmm. we need to translate that goal to all levels in the organization. Mm. This process of translation has to be both ways, meaning the goals are set from the top, mm-hmm. but before we say that is the goal, there has to be feedback from the bottom. Say, guys, is that realistic? Mm-hmm. Yes, it is possible to do, but I need 1, 2, and 3. Mm-hmm. This is what is called as the catch ball process within the Hoshin framework, mm-hmm. where we have an engagement between all levels of the organization on what we should get done this year, next year, and the year after.
Ah.
Therefore, when the team when the cell has to create 2x the output, they know why that is important.
Yeah.
So this monitoring of work has to be at the cell level itself, so they track the performance by the hour.
Mm-hmm.
if they come to a bottleneck where they are unable to get help, as an example, from purchasing, then the manager steps in and say, hey, why is purchasing not helping you? Let me take that, work with purchasing, and get you what you want so that you can be successful.
So I think that our audience will probably see that you're even talking about concepts like servant leadership. I know when I went through our operational priorities accelerator model, you were quick to point out, Greg, this is basically Hoshin, in a way, and which I guess probably has been done many times. People package those concepts and ideas and do them in different ways. Mm-hmm. So you mentioned a work team going 2x, and it reminds me of a story that you relayed to me a few months ago when we were talking about a client project that you were working on. And I think, as I recall, what you said is that they had order, at that point at least, order volume that was essentially twice as much as what the plant could produce on a regular basis. And they were kind of stuck. I mean, the plant was running at capacity and they were delivering as best they could, but there was this concept of twice as much business was available if they could only figure out a way to deliver it. And I wonder if you could share just a couple of insights that you saw on that journey to increasing capacity with maybe surprisingly less change than you'd think would be required.
Yeah, thank you, Greg. I think that's one of the very good works which we have done recently. The key aspect of that work, from my perspective, is we took a lot of care in putting the team together. Mm. So I did some prep work with the leadership at the plant, the division leadership, and said, guys, what is the problem we are trying to address? And therefore, who should be in that core team? Mm-hmm. Once we had the 8 team member core team, I call it as bringing them into the crucible. Mm. So this is not something I show them a PowerPoint deck, we are done, let's go and work. It does not work that way. We have to take the time, because we all learn differently. We spent a lot of time as a team, all 8, together in the classroom, going on to the floor and actually observing, doing the work, mm-hmm. coming back. Why are we doing the way it is? And I go back to what I said earlier. If what we currently do is 98% red and yellow, wasteful work, what can the team members do to reduce the yellow and the red? Mm-hmm. And or what should the leadership do to reduce the yellow and the red?
Yeah. So just to jump in there for a second, red are things that you shouldn't do and you could stop doing immediately. It wouldn't have much of an impact on the process. And yellow are things where I guess you need to maybe re-engineer the work little bit in order to eliminate that waste. All right, so you help them see the red and the yellow.
Yes.
And they're surrounded by the support to do that. Then still, how did you get it to the point where they were able to break through and essentially double the capacity with very little cost increase?
To me, it was very easy. Mm-hmm. Very easy, because we took the time for the team members to fully immerse in what are the challenges. It's not that I'm done.
So they saw the challenges firsthand.
Firsthand, yes.
And therefore, they kind of had that feeling that it's not right or could be better.
Yeah.
And then what?
And then what becomes, going back to what you said about servant leadership, making each of the team members in the workshop understand that they are working for the frontline team members who are doing the work. Mm-hmm. They are the bosses, the supervisors, managers, etc. Doesn't really matter. For me to be successful as a manager, I have to make sure my team is successful. Mm-hmm. So that concept, I think it is a challenge for most of us to believe. We can talk about it, mm-hmm. but actually behave consistent to that value is a challenge.
Mm. Yeah.
So my job there is to make sure we always, I call it out the way it is. Hey, Greg, I saw you do that. That is not what we agreed is what we should do. Mm. Over 3 weeks period, 3 weeks over a month, we kind of lived the challenge. Mm. And what was very quickly we could find out was that we could do some very, very simple, no capex, and we could increase throughput significantly. And it's funny, this was done about 4 years ago, the team is still making improvements.
Wow.
Still making improvements.
Yeah.
Because now it is part of their DNA.
Yeah.
It is not Vadish telling them what to do.
Yeah.
And there's one thing I never do in my work, I never tell anyone what they should do.
Yeah.
I said, this is the principle. This is where we want to go. How do you apply the principle?
Yeah, I think maybe that might surprise people. I know I get inquiries from some of our clients where they go, we need a CI course or a lean course or a 5S course or something. And so I call you usually because you're my go-to for that. And I say, Vadish, they want a course. And you go, Greg, a course isn't going to get the results. They have to essentially learn hands-on by doing.
Yes.
Then it gets deep into their bones and they understand it at a profound level, and then they can repeat it over and over again.
Exactly.
And become self-sufficient. Mm-hmm. And I think clients initially, like, I just wanted a course, but what they really want is results.
Yes,
and,
exactly.
And, or at least impact.
Mm-hmm.
Funny enough that you talked about Deming, and I remember my father who worked at a General Motors subsidiary, and they brought the Deming folks in to just talk about their consulting services. And as my dad told it to me, he said, what the Deming folks said is, we don't think that you're really committed. Unless
yes.
you're committed to working with us for a 3-year period, we don't think you're serious enough. And if you're not serious enough, we just don't want to waste our time.
Exactly.
And,
correct.
And so I think that goes back to the early uptake that Deming saw from true believers
yes.
who are willing to do the work, right?
Exactly.
Yeah. So you and your son, actually, and your son is also an engineer, professional engineer like you are. The two of you got a chance to present to the ASQ World Conference. And I just wondered, what is it that you were sharing together? And I think you wrote a paper together on
That's
it.
That's correct.
What was the basis of that sort of knowledge that you were sharing with them?
So our focus in sharing with the general audience at the conference was, what are the systemic structures we need to have in place so that the gains are sustained?
Ah, so it was really around gain sustainment and making sure that the structures support the sustainment of that.
Right.
What were some of the interesting parts of that? Like, what did you determine or at least put forward as the key things to creating that structure?
Yeah, so in our view, the structure comes from the leaders having the right values.
Mm.
What do I mean? Once I subscribe to the value, respect my people,
mm-hmm.
means I do things differently.
Mm.
I am not waiting for a report to come to me. I go to where the team member is and I see
mm-hmm.
what he or she is struggling with.
Mm.
Therefore, I am very intimate with the red and the yellow. So that was one of the key points we shared with them. And also, where does this values come from? There's a lot of work at the moment available that talks about some very key values for the CI journey, and tying Dr. Deming's work and Dr. Senge's work, Dr. Senge calls them as mental models.
Mm-hmm.
The mental model is what drives me or makes me do what I talk about.
Mm-hmm.
And my observation, don't get me wrong when I say this very bluntly, we have a tremendous gap between what I believe, what I say, and what I do.
Mm.
Major disconnect. And when I'm working with my clients, I call it out. I say, this is the condition. If you want me to work with you, I will. But mm-hmm. you, as leaders, you need to step out, because I am convinced with data that the issue is not the team members, issue is you.
Very good, very good. We always say that everything is a leadership problem to some degree. Both success and setbacks.
Yes.
So really, leaders, probably by accident, just don't confront those realities, right? I'm not sure that they would have the intent of not doing it, but embracing that idea that my primary responsibility is to support my team in delivering results,
mm-hmm.
right? And not that the team reports to me or is there to serve me. The team is there to serve the process and the customer, and I'm there to serve the team. And so you're saying, once you get alignment around that, it sort of takes away the things that are in organizations that end up kicking up barriers to continuous improvement.
Yeah, my language is friction.
Yeah.
Any friction that we create that is preventing the team member to have a good day's work. Mm-hmm. What does good day work look for me? It is like a ballet. Mm-hmm. It flows.
Yeah.
Start to finish, the work flows. And going back to this client, all we did was got rid of all the noise that prevents
and the
flow.
Friction. Yeah.
And the friction that prevents the flow from happening.
Yeah, yeah, which is great, because when you think about it, most people want to do a good job every day.
Exactly right.
And then they get frustrations or barriers put in the way. And then they learn to accept that those barriers and frustrations exist, and they just think it's part of the process.
That's right.
And you're saying that once you help them see it and acknowledge it and give them permission to share it, and then own, well, what if we could change that?
Yes.
What if we could change that?
Yes.
And I think that speaks to why your projects generate such a high amount of impact and why you're invited back to keep moving. I'm always surprised, by the way, we're talking with Vadish Subramanian. And you can visit him at aimsinc.ca, but I would say that don't go there thinking he's got the world's best continuous improvement website or lean.
I don't.
He works a lot on word of mouth and referrals and repeat business.
Yes.
It's always super impressive. So the best thing I can suggest is if you're interested in working with Vadish, that you actually reach out and have a conversation with him. Invite him to come and see your process and walk through it, because he's going to reveal some insights and you'll get a handle on his practicality. I'm wondering, Vadish, when you go back to your own career journey, because you got your engineering degree and you started working in automotive, and maybe before the lesson that you saw at Toyota when you were there, I'm just wondering, when did things click for you? Because for most people early on in their career, they're never sure if they have the confidence because they haven't maybe had enough wins yet. But at some point they get a win and then it sort of clicks and they get this confidence level. Can you think about when things clicked for you in your career, like a certain project or a certain opportunity where you go, I got something here? When did you get that sense?
I don't want to sound arrogant, but I got my first job from the campus interview.
Mm.
So I got my job a year and a half before I graduate from a master's program.
Nice.
So got an extra bucks each month to keep me along with that company. So I go to the company first day on the job, and I met with the two folks who came from the company to the institute to hire us. And when I reflect back on what he told me, he said, Vadish, before you go into the design office, I want you to go and run every single machine on the floor.
Hmm.
I was pissed at that moment. I had spent so much time in university getting my master's program. Now he wants me to
become a machine operator.
Yeah, machine operator. I was going to clean the machines, lubing the machines, running the machines, etc. But looking back, that is the best thing I did in my life. Now I have a tremendous respect for the frontline team members. How? Yeah. In spite of the stupidity of us as leaders, they are still able to deliver what we want them to deliver.
Interesting. So this is, by the way, there's a couple of good lessons in there. Number one is sometimes leaders will antagonize their reports by suggesting that they go and do this, I think they call it scut work in the medical work or grunt work.
Yes.
And the people aren't necessarily happy from it. And then I've heard many people like you say that they learned a lot by doing that.
Yes.
And especially about how to gain the respect of people who continue to do that. Because if you think about lean, continuous improvement, operational excellence, it's really about harnessing the power of the folks that are running the machines to remove their frustrations.
That's
and friction.
Right. Yes,
right?
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah. What I was curious of is, do you have anything maybe that you wanted to share that we haven't already discussed or probed in our conversation so far?
Yeah, one thing, once I get to know the leadership team and we are on a dialogue mode, not a discussion mode, then I tell them, guys, we are all captive to our thought processes. If you want a different outcome, we have to change our thought pattern.
Yeah.
And the way to change the thought pattern is to subscribe to, intellectually, a different set of values. So if there's alignment on the values, if we as leaders are open to recognizing a different set of values, that basically means they agree to behave differently.
Right. So the values are in the behaviors. Values, it's interesting because we have clients where they talk about values and a lot of them are words on the wall,
yes,
but they don't really reflect the behaviors of the leadership team or even what gets measured and so forth. So when you talk about them changing their values, can you give an example of something? I think you have already in our discussion, but you know, what's an example of a value that they might need to confront and change that will, I guess, either impede progress if they don't change it or would accelerate progress if they did change it?
So if you go back and look at the Toyota production system documentation, what we will find that two fundamental values are the following. First, respect for people. Mm. And second, focus on continuous improvement, mm-hmm, in that order.
Mm-hmm.
So what does respect for people mean?
Mm-hmm.
So what we find in our work is if we challenge our team members to the next improvement,
mm-hmm,
and let them lead that improvement, we are actually showing them respect. Now they're not just a pair of hands, mm-hmm, doing the work, they also apply the thinking to the work.
Yeah.
But the fundamental change their requirement is we as leaders, we have to come up with a different set of values. We have to subscribe to a different set of values and therefore behave differently.
Yeah.
So in my work, we have a scale to measure the progress on behavior.
Mm-hmm.
At the end of every meeting, the last 3 to 5 minutes of every meeting, we go back to the scale that we came up with. Yeah. Nobody told us that. This is our scale.
Yeah.
How did we do on the scale?
Mm-hmm.
How frequently did we meet the scale?
Yeah.
How pervasive was it? If not, we need to step back. Guys, this is what we said we have to do because this is the goal we need to achieve. Let's step back. Why are we not behaving to what we agreed to do?
Yeah.
That is when you need to have those difficult conversations.
So I'm curious. I think you're always right in my mind because I think you're brilliant.
I learn all the time.
So what I'm curious of though is, even though you're very clear about what is required, can you comment on management teams that get it versus don't get it, or say that they're going to believe in it and then they don't? Is there any other takeaway that someone in our audience would be able to tell whether their organization is truly ready to embrace this way of thinking?
I'll give you an example. I was reached out by a venture fund in California, and they wanted to invest in a frozen pizza business in India.
Mm-hmm.
So they have identified a bakery in India. So they said, can you go and take a look and tell us what you think about the bakery and how ready are they? Are they to launch the frozen pizza business in India? I'm going back about 9-10 years now.
Mm-hmm.
And they took me out to India. I met with the MD. MD is a typical top guy in the Indian context.
Managing director. Okay.
Yeah. And for an Indian, he was huge. He was 6'3".
Oh, wow.
Very, very out of proportion for Indian folks. But I met with him and said, Mr. Khosla, can we take a walk to your bakery? Let's go for a walk in your mm-hmm. bakery. He was completely ruffled. He said, oh, I don't go to my bakery. I have my manufacturing director. He can take you. I said, no, Mr. Khosla, I want you to go with me on the tour. He did not.
Mm-hmm.
So that afternoon, they say, Mr. Khosla, these are my expenses. Please take care. When you're ready, I'll come back.
Mm-hmm.
3 months later, he was not there. And we have a new leadership who was there to do what has to be done.
Mm-hmm.
And what I find, this is what I'm always judging when I'm signing up with a new client, is he or she ready to do the hard work? If they are not ready, I says, thank you very much. I love your money. Thank you very much. Let me know when you're ready.
Yeah.
I don't want to take this up. Because
that's the nice thing about being a practitioner like yourself is you've gotten to the point where you don't take the job just to have the job.
No.
But I guess what you're saying in there is because he was so... he would struggle so much with going to the plant.
Yeah.
You already knew that he wasn't respectful and had a relationship there.
Yes.
And that was just an indicator.
That's correct.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Yeah. So if someone again in the audience is saying, hey, when our senior executives visit the plant, everything becomes a turmoil, that would be a negative indicator, right? Whereas if everyone is comfortable on the floor and everyone has this nice, collegial, respectful relationship, there's probably the basis or the fertile ground to start to look at making improvements.
Exactly correct, Greg. And we talk a lot about 5S, and I hate that tool, 5S, because it's completely misapplied. When I start with my client, I says, we'll get to 5S, but what I want you is you as leaders, you have to create your standard work. Leaders have to create their standard work. And the content of the standard work is such that when the leaders deliver on that behavior, I will get the required outcome. It's tied to the outcome. So very often, most OPEX consultants, trainers, coaches, they start with doing 5S at the front line. It will never sustain.
It'll be a constant game of whack-a-mole.
Exactly.
Trying to make it work. Right.
So,
and you're saying start at the leader standard
Absolutely.
And if the leaders are doing what they're supposed to do, then the 5S will occur.
Absolutely.
Okay. So that brings up the question, although I think we've probably answered it, is why do companies do it the wrong way? And why do the consultants keep doing it that way? It's almost like there's this co-conspiracy to not make it successful, but not on purpose, maybe by accident. I don't know what, and a sort of follow-up would be leader standard work. I see clients embracing that, but it's almost like they've cut and paste the leader standard work from some standard generic version.
Exactly.
And they haven't really made it for their business,
That's
so therefore correct. It doesn't really get complied with.
Exactly.
So any other commentary about why do people still go through this charade of thinking that they're going to achieve results when really they're going to only achieve results as long as the consultant is there?
That's
and then
correct.
After that, it's going to fall apart.
Yeah. So once the leaders sign up to doing the standard work, the leader's standard work, and I'll give you a crazy example. I go to Costco here in North London at least two or three times a month. And Costco is one of the very few organizations that has marked the parking lot beautifully. The paint is always fresh. You can see the lines. And it really bothers me when I see a family, mother or father with the kids, they cut across the parking lot where there's no pedestrian crossing marked. All over the place. Now I say, if at this point we are not showing our team, our youngsters, hey, this is where we need to cross. I can't cross wherever I want. We have to cross where the white lines are, the pedestrian crossing lines. So that kind of builds in. We as leaders believe the standard work is meant for our frontline team members.
But not for us.
Not for us.
Okay.
Not for us. Okay. So I turn it backwards and say, unless you start leaving your standard work, doing anything on the front line is a waste of time.
Interesting. Cool. So this goes back to leaders. It starts with the leadership.
Absolutely.
And the leadership doing the right things right then allows other people to do the right things right.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly. Right. So the leader's job is to make the important things urgent. Not let the urgent things override everything else.
Okay, so that goes back to the Eisenhower matrix of urgent versus important.
That's
correct. I know that in our frontline leadership drive performance program, we do focus on that. Like, what a lot of supervisors are just the tyranny of the urgent. They're only working on the urgent, not the important. But I love how you said making the important urgent is a great way of putting that, because if you don't, the urgent will always take over the
exactly
important.
Exactly correct,
Yeah, neat, okay. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, again, we've been talking with Vadish Subramanian of AIMSinc.ca. So AIMSinc.ca is where you can reach him. He's also very good and active on LinkedIn, and I'd suggest that you connect with him. And I just wanted to say, you know, I'm just so glad that we took one of our telephone discussions, which, again, we've had of similar length, but didn't record them. I think we should record them all going forward. So I just wanted to say thank you for being our guest here on the Accelerating Operational Performance podcast.
Great, great to be with you. Yeah. I always look forward to your feedback, counsel, and guidance.
All right. Yeah. And again, this draws to a close our episode this week. Again, if you like the podcast, which many people do, please, of course, like and subscribe and tell someone else about it. It really helps us grow our audience. If we can be of any service, if you need me to connect you to Vadish, or if you need anything to do with leadership training for your plant managers on down to your supervisors, you can reach out to us at uniquedevelopment.com.